23-2265, Eastern Missouri, Devin Arsenault versus Elaine Podlowski et al.
All right, Mr. Worley, we'll hear from you first.
May it please the court, my name is Chris Worley. I represent the appellant, Devin Arsenault. It's a privilege and an honor to be here this morning. Thank you very much. This case started as a divorce out in St. Louis County, and as a result of some of the conduct and the facts of that divorce, it ended up being filed as a 1983 case against three of the defendants, two GALs and a therapist appointed in the divorce case. It was filed as a 1983 case downstairs in district court. The district court took up a motion to dismiss the petition, the verified petition we filed, and they found blanket immunity across the board. Pretty simple decision, really. They found that all of the allegations that we made in our complaint were covered under immunity and such that they were dismissed. The allegations we have in our complaint in the district court include really intentional conduct, as we alleged, intentional conduct of misrepresentation, intentional conduct of falsifying testimony and evidence, and then intentional conduct of threatening a witness to settle the case or she wouldn't see her kids again. So that leads us here. And I have a little bit of trouble with some of the allegations we made. And there's a whole, as the court is aware, there's a whole line of cases about immunity. And immunity is a pretty strong concept, and it covers a lot of behavior, and appellant acknowledges that. But what we have here is what I believe are exceptions to the immunity. And I believe we have intentional conduct that's both negative and against the course of the case and against judicial conduct that harm plaintiff, that harm the appellant, and I believe is beyond immunity. And if the court just looks at a couple of cases, and we cite a couple of cases in our brief. One of the cases I think the court is well known, the court is very familiar with, is the Dornheim case, and that's an often cited case in. Bear with me one second, will I? That behavior that's within the course of judicial conduct and within the course of the appointment is covered by immunity. And I believe that what we have is behavior that's beyond that. And there's a case that came out of this court last year, and this illustrates my point. It's the Rocket versus Amy case, and it's kind of a goofy, unusual case where a judge took it upon himself to put a couple of kids in jail, and he actually did it himself. He took the kids over to the jail, unlocked the jail, put them in, and he did all that himself. And the court found that, you know, while he was a judge, that's conduct that is beyond what being a judge is. He was being a jailer. And so the court dispensed with immunity in that case. Well, it's the same thing we have here. We've got a situation where a GAL knows that they're putting on false evidence. They know that they're putting on misleading evidence. They know that they're threatening a witness. That's not accidental conduct. That's intentional conduct. And that's beyond the scope of the job.
Well, let me ask you this. What about Rooker-Feldt? You say it doesn't apply, but, I mean, why is it here? Why isn't it in the Missouri Supreme Court or in the Missouri Court of Appeals?
Rooker-Feldt wasn't really part of the district court's order to dismiss the case. So I haven't really focused much on that in my brief. I mean, I mentioned it, but it's not really the focal point of my brief. But I think Rooker-Feldt, as I recall, means you're just relitigating the case in a different place. You're relitigating a state court case in federal court. And that's really not the case here. We're taking up a 1983 case of first impression, at least in this case.
But you're asking for us to vacate the judgment of the state court.
Based on immunity. Based on, the wrongful immunity decision in the district court.
No, but you, in the district court, you asked the district court to vacate the judgment of the state court. And that's Rooker-Feldman.
No, that's not correct. At least, to my knowledge, that's not correct. That's not the relief.
The district court said. So the district court got it wrong about what you're asking for?
Well, the relief I'm seeking is to vacate the district court's decision to dismiss the complaint.
Yeah, but what did you want the district court to do? What relief are you seeking in this federal action?
Damages based on 1983 conduct, as alleged in our complaint in district court. I'm not looking to set aside the state court judgment. I never did seek to set aside the state court judgment.
Judge Pidlick said you did, and if you look at your complaint, you say you do.
Well, but the focus of our appeal is really on the part of the court's decision that dismisses our complaint based on immunity.
And so you're abandoning any claim to set aside the state court judgment?
I never meant to make that claim. If that claim is in there, that was superfluous. It was probably part of the complaint that, in retrospect, probably shouldn't have been part in there. But
the only thing you're seeking at this point is damages.
Well, damages in the underlying 1983 case in the district court. That's correct.
That's the only part of a case that you want to have remanded for further proceedings.
That's correct. Yeah, and the part of the case that was thrown out for immunity. That's correct. And those were the 1983 allegations.
And do those damages stem from the state court judgment, or do they stem independently actions of the defendants? Here?
Well, they stem from the actions of defendants as it affected plaintiff. But it's a first impression in the district court. We didn't seek that remedy in state court. So, you know, we took up the behavior of defendants as a 1983 case in district court. And as far as I know, that's the only remedy I'm seeking. Which is what the immunity cases address. And, you know, when I'm trying to distinguish this case from those long line of immunity cases.
All right. Well, do you have anything more to say about the immunity law?
Just to reiterate my point that I think that the allegations we have in our complaint go well beyond conduct that's covered by immunity. I don't want to be repetitive, but I can't understand, both as a matter of law and really as a matter of common sense, how a GAL can take a litigant witness aside outside the courtroom and say, settle this case, you'll never see your kids again. And that's an allegation in our complaint that was dismissed for immunity. And I don't understand how that level of intentional conduct can be covered by immunity. I can't understand that.
What about the question whether a guardian ad litem acts under color of state law? What's your view on that?
Well, I don't think that does away with my argument under immunity in this court or in the district court under 1983.
No, I'm saying there's a separate requirement for 1983 action that the defendant act under color of state law.
Well, they're appointed by a state judge. They're part of the judicial process. They get immunity for that purpose. I don't know how they're not acting under color of state law in that position as either a GAL or a therapist. That's a state court. They're acting under appointment of a state judge. And that's state law that they're acting under, at least in that part of the job. So I don't know how that's not under color of state law. I mean, that dovetails with us going into district court seeking 1983 remedy. I'm eating into my rebuttal time.
You may reserve.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Who's going to argue for the defense here? Mr. Goldberger?
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Dustin Goldberger, and I represent the Dunlop appellees in this case. That is Brian Dunlop and his law firm Dunlop and McCarter. It probably makes sense to kind of discuss some of the issues that were brought up. As the court has pointed out, there are a couple of different issues that were raised by all of the appellees and all the defendants in this case regarding the insufficiency of the pleadings. Primarily, obviously, Judge Pitlick and the district court found, based the determination that the complaint verified petition was insufficient based on the issue of immunity. As Judge Malloy pointed out, we would also argue we believe Rooker-Feldman doctrine does apply here. As the court is aware, the Rooker-Feldman doctrine prevents the litigation in federal court of any claims that essentially constitute an attack on a state court judgment. And essentially, Your Honors, based on a review of the pleadings in this case, it's clear that's exactly what it is. As Judge Malloy pointed out, the record in this case, it's unclear what is and not is being sought today. But based on our review of the record in this case, I believe it's page 12 of the appendix has the amended, the verified petition, the pleadings in this case, and it states clearly they're seeking not only to vacate the judgment, but to strike testimony from the record. That's impermissible. I would direct the court to Ballinger v. Coletta. That is a very on-point case, both with respect to the facts and the law. In that case, similar sort of circumstances, the parent of in a child custody dispute in state court brought 1983 claims. It was a Missouri state court case, underlying case, brought claims against various actors. And the district court in that case actually dismissed on the grounds that the claims were time barred. But this court reviewed the issue and decided to pass on that and decided instead to assess Rooker-Feldman. And it found because the parent in that case, the Ballinger case, like the one here, was challenging the ruling or essentially was asking the court to grant relief that would basically be tantamount to finding that the state court erred in that child custody case, Rooker-Feldman was applicable to that case and barred those claims. And I would note that it did affirm the dismissal with prejudice of those that the district court order entered dismissing the claims with prejudice, but also the request for leave to amend the pleadings, which, as the court will note, is
Ballinger predates ExxonMobil, though, right?
Yes, it does, Your Honor.
Things tightened up a little bit with ExxonMobil and Rooker-Feldman world.
I believe so, Your Honor. I would note, perhaps, then, that maybe the more appropriate relief would be at best, I mean, again, the court has the discretion to affirm on any basis supported in the record, as the court knows, but if the court did decide to focus on the issue of Rooker-Feldman doctrine, perhaps modifying the order with a dismissal without prejudice, given that it's a subject matter jurisdiction issue. But I think that the Exxon case, in terms of the fact that literally the relief being asked for in this case is vacating a state court judgment, under Exxon,
Didn't they also ask for damages arising from these alleged false statements over and above anything that happened in state court?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. And I guess if we parse that out, perhaps there's an argument to be made. I haven't really seen case law distinguishing between sort of a kitchen sink approach or a kind of separating out when multiple forms of relief are requested. Most of the case law I've seen, and I believe Your Honor is correct, Ballinger does predate a lot of the Exxon and its progeny, but most of the case law I've seen, it's either a straightforward damages claim or it's a request for an injunction or equity. So it's a little bit different. But regardless, Judge Carlton pointed out, there's also the question of whether they're actors.
The defendants are acting under color of state law was my question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you have a view on that?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't believe there's any case law that would support the notion that a court-appointed GAL is a state actor for purposes of a 1983 claim. I'd direct the court's attention to the closest thing that I would say is on point with that, which is the Harkins v. Eldridge case. It's a 1974 case, which says that the conduct of counsel, either retained or appointed in representing clients, does not constitute action under color of state law for purposes of a 1983 violation. And, Your Honors, that's exactly what happened. Obviously, it's a little bit different with the GAL. The duties and the function features of the GAL are a little bit different than a straightforward attorney-client relationship. but that's the closest thing that the Eighth Circuit has come to addressing that color of law issue for purposes of GALs. And besides, Your Honors, as the court is well aware...
Is the guardian ad litem strictly representing the interests of a non-state party?
Your Honor, if I may, the GAL in Missouri has sort of a hybrid function, but their allegiance, their principal allegiance is to the court. So they don't technically, our position and supported by Missouri statute is the appointment of a guardian ad litem in a custody case is to serve and the principal allegiance is to the trial court. So their goal is to protect the best interest of the child. But in terms of who they represent and who their duties are owed to, that is the principal allegiance is to the court.
Well, how does that hurt your argument on color of state law if their loyalty is to the state and not to the minor?
Your Honor, may I
say? Yeah, please.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that
does the guardian ad litem owe loyalty to the minor or to the state?
To the state, Your Honor.
Well, I'm not sure that helps your argument on color of state law. I'm also not sure whether it's correct. I thought their obligation was to pursue the best interest of the minor.
So the mandate, Your Honor, is to protect the best interest of the child. The principal allegiance is owed to the court in terms of they essentially function. A case law is, I believe my colleague might have briefed some of this state-related or through Byrd-Weinstock. That's a Missouri case, and it kind of is a common law discussion of some of these family law statutes, specifically the appointment of a guardian ad litem. And, Your Honor, it is sort of a strange that the court described the function of a Missouri guardian ad litem as a hybrid. The distinction, Your Honor, being that in an attorney-client relationship, I have a duty solely to advocate for my client's interests, such as a court-appointed attorney for a child. But a guardian ad litem's principal allegiance is to the court. However, it's not an actual court employee. It's simply a private attorney who is appointed to fulfill that role.
You say there's a Missouri case that goes through that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Which one?
I don't have the...
What's the name of it?
It's called State X. Rel. Byrd, Your Honor, B-I-R-D, versus Weinstock, W-E-I-N-S-T-O-C-K.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for your argument. Mr. Bronski, we'll hear from you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Honors. A.J. Bronski, on behalf of Elaine Podlowski and her law firm. I want to clear up something there about this color of state law issue. I believe that the Byrd versus Weinstock case that was just referred to, the Missouri case, and then there's another case called Tolu versus Reed that the Missouri Court of Appeals decided within the past couple of years. In Missouri, the GAL serves to provide the court with independent information with respect to what is in the best interest of the child. That's what the common law case law is in Missouri. That means that the overall duty and responsibility of the GAL is to act in the best interest of the child as a reporter to the court. But the GAL is not bound to the court. It's not instructed by the court. It's similar to the situation of a court-appointed public defender. And there's a case called Polk versus Dotson where the Supreme Court determined that a public defender is not acting under color of state law for purposes of 1983. And although this circuit has not ruled specifically on that, numerous other circuits have found the same rationale as the Polk case that a GAL does not act under color of state law. And there is a district court case out of Iowa, and I'll screw up the name of it, but it's cited in my brief. It's SOPHPMSAY versus City of Sargent Bluff, Iowa. Rooker-Feldman absolutely applies to this verified petition because the verified petition asks for injunctive relief, and in the Danum Clause specifically asked that the state court judgment be vacated, as well as counsel indicated, testimony from the state court record be vacated. So Rooker-Feldman at least applies to that. Again, as to 1983, the whole case law within the Eighth Circuit from the Dornum versus Soles case and the Myers case, and there's another Polk County case, McEwen versus Polk County, they all hold that if the GAL is doing normal functions, they are entitled to immunity. The GALs in this case were, in fact, conducting normal activities. They were cross-examining witnesses. They were presenting evidence to the court for the court's determination as to whether or not child custody should be awarded in some fashion or another between these particular parents. And nothing that has been pled, and the pleadings are very, very factually unspecific and conclusory, would give rise to not granting immunity to the GALs. My time's up. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you for your argument. Mr. Alheim.
May it please the court. On behalf of Dr. Reed, I want to reemphasize that the Dornum case, as well as the Morstadt case from the Eighth Circuit, we are the court-appointed psychologist that was asked to do a custody evaluation. The underlying mother and father consented to the appointment of Dr. Reed to serve as this role. And in those cases that I talked about, the Dornheim and Morstadt, they say specifically a court-appointed psychiatrist enjoyed absolute immunity for the testimony and reports they submitted to the court. We have complete and total immunity, and that stems because they were the whole point of him being appointed was to be able to provide an independent opinion. That served as the basis for, at least partially the basis for the judgment down in the family court as well. So Dr. Reed submitted a report. He was called to testify. He was subject to cross-examination. He was subject to all of counter experts. And ultimately, it was the trial court in state court that made a determination as to credibility and how much weight to give to certain testimony versus others. Now, plaintiff in this case, appellant in this case, wants to undermine the underlying family court decision and the rationale behind it. They want the district court to find that the family court's decision as to the credibility of certain witnesses are now subject to damages. And it's completely, entirely inappropriate under the immunity arguments, as well as the Rooker-Feldman and Younger Doctrine cases. The last thing I would just point out is there's still ongoing proceedings in the family court and state court. This thing has been in constant litigation since 2013. In fact, there's a case pending in St. Charles County right now with filings as of May of 2024. This is an ongoing state proceedings. My time is up.
All right. Thank you for your argument. You have a minute remaining. You may proceed.
Thank you, Ron. I just want to address a couple of things very quickly. There's an Eighth Circuit case from 1996 that says it's firmly established that a defendant in a 1983 suit acts under color of state law when he abuses the position given to him by the state. Well, in this case, I think that's exactly what we have here.
What was that case?
Parker versus Boyer, 93 F 3rd, 445. And I think that's exactly what we have here. We have positions created by the state. They appear at a hearing in state court, and the various allegations follow of the behavior in state court.
Well, putting aside Rooker-Feldman, the last comment made by opposing counsel basically said we should abstain under sort of some abstention doctrine, since you're litigating this in state court, or litigating something in state court.
Well,
why shouldn't we just let the state court handle the whole thing?
Well, because the allegations are tied to civil rights violations, and if you look at our complaint, we allege 1983 violations, which I believe fulfilled 1983 requirements, and that conduct's already completed. So that's already in our complaint. And I will acknowledge that, and I know my time is up, but I will acknowledge that our complaint did seek a Rooker-Feldman type remedy and damages. So the court could, those are both, parallel presented in the complaint. So the court could certainly parse those out, leave the damages, get rid of the injunctive relief, Rooker-Feldman type of remedy. But it's consistent that we requested damages under 1983.
Who is the defendant in Parker against Boyer? It wasn't a guardian ad litem, was it?
I don't have that information, Your Honor. I only have.
You stated a general proposition, but you have to get into the facts as to what the person is doing to understand whether they're acting under color of state law. A public defender is appointed by the state, but is not acting under color of state law. So we'll look at Parker. I just wondered if you knew.
Yes, sir.
Knew the particulars. Thank you for your argument.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you to all counsel.
Thank you all very much.
The case is submitted. The court will file a decision in due course. That concludes the argument.